show. This is the Angry GM. And if you're listening to this, what you're listening to is sort of the question and answer follow-up to the proofread aloud of the article, Why Run Games Anyway? And Angry New Year Story, or whatever I entitled it. But this isn't a Q&A in the usual sense, because what happened was this. Yesterday, when I recorded that proofread aloud, I followed it with a Q&A. And for a variety of personal reasons, the Q&A did not go very well, and I did not approach it in the best of moods or mindsets, and did not feel comfortable posting what I actually recorded. Rather than just dumping it and saying no Q&A at all, I instead decided that I would re-record the Q&A today with whatever audience showed up, and even bring over the questions from yesterday, especially those I had ignored. But then I'm also expanding it, so, you know, this will be about 45 minutes, and after I run through the questions from yesterday and give them actual good responses, I will happily take any additional questions and comments for the time I have. And of course, Proselis is on hand to tell me when the time I have is done, when I no longer have it anymore. So we'll just hang out and run through some questions. And I'm going to post this as the supplemental Q&A, but this is also sort of, I guess, a New Year's wrap-up. Like, you know, bidding goodbye to 2022 and, you know, staring straight down the barrel of 2023. So with that, I guess let's get to the Q's and A's. So Dan Floor asked yesterday, and I dismissed this question out of crankiness, how did I break my home game? Because I mentioned in the article that I had broken one of my two games. Now, there's a longer story to this, and I am not entirely at fault, except insofar as I am the GM, and so I am entirely at fault. But essentially what happened was Tiny was running a campaign of her own on alternating Friday nights. She started her own Tomb of Annihilation game. She was having fun with that, and that left me alone with nothing to do on alternating Friday nights. So I tapped a few friends online and said, hey, do you want me to run a game on alternating Friday nights? And people weren't able to really commit to anything long term. So I'm like, okay, here's what I'll do. I'll write and run what I was calling a short shot, basically a three or four month, basically what, like I think I was targeting eight sessions, an eight session mini campaign. And I wrote a little story and we were going to do that. And, so the thing is though, that I had my hope, I had hoped that I would be able to leverage this into getting an ongoing commitment from the players to keep it going longer than just the couple of months that it was supposed to go. And on top of that, I didn't really change my style of writing or running games for the fact that I was running a very limited game. In general, I like to kind of spread out and take my time with a game. It helps with the world building, and it allows me to do all the things that I happen to be particularly good at. But by the same token, it means my games don't get a whole lot accomplished in any one session, and I have gradually come to terms with that, that my games are slower paced, especially because I'm running them online. The problem is, when you promise a limited campaign, and you promise a complete story, and you have basically this three-chapter story that's going to be divided into four chapter stories, so four two-session adventures, basically, that string together into a campaign. If you start going over time, you're screwed. So I did not adjust my style for writing or running the game, and on top of that, one of the players suddenly imposed additional time restrictions. They weren't any longer than the time restrictions I'd already been laboring under, really. It was like, just cut an extra hour out of every session. But then I had some health problems and some of the players had trips, so we missed a couple of sessions here and there. And when you're already only running every other week, Even one missed session is kind of disastrous, especially if you're trying to build a world sense in an ongoing story. I was also teaching these players 3.5 because I wanted to run that. But because they didn't have a whole lot of experience with 3.5, and that's kind of a heavyweight system, even going once every 2 weeks for them to constantly be basically relearning the basics of 3.5 every 2 weeks because they forgot things from 1 week to the next, and also relearning just how to use the Fantasy Grounds tabletop that I was using, even though I was handling kind of most of things on the background, it was just a recipe for disaster, and ultimately I had to pull the plug on the game. The end. So I broke it, but there were other extenuating circumstances that also broke it, and a couple of the remaining players, along with two other new players, have agreed to start something fresh and new in January, and to make it more of an ongoing thing, so that I don't have to deal with the whole constraint to trying to cram a single story, or, you know, a story into just a limited number of sessions. Which this is good for Dan Floor's follow-up, any game ideas you are excited to run in 2023. I am excited to start this game, but I am also terrified because I don't know what I want to do with it, and looking at my own needs, as I'm spelling out the needs for the game, you know, what it is, like, I don't mean like, I want elves and I want, you know, I want it to take place in this kind of world, but I mean just general, like, the actual constraints of the game. Like, how much time do I actually have to commit to this game? And, you know, with knowing that it's only going to be every 2 weeks, what sort of, you know, how can I build the game for success within those constraints and how much time I have and all of that stuff? But also there's some things that I want in the game. And I actually am afraid, and it's hard for me to answer these questions because I know there's a chance that any one of the players might be listening to anything I say. And so I never want this to be a situation where I'm like yelling or complaining about my players by answering a question or hoping they'll hear it or hoping they're not going to hear it. And it's okay because I will never say anything that I'm an honest person. So I will not deceive my players or hide things. And so there is nothing I will say now that I wouldn't also say to my players' faces. That said, I know some of them have certain expectations and desires for a game because, you know, I mean, this is all the whole celebrity bullshit and I hate even talking about it, but it's like, you know, I'm the angry GM. I'm running an angry game and there's certain things, I get to be in an angry game. And there's certain things you want out of that. You want to see, like, you want to be in the Angryverse, or you want to, you know, experience these rules or these systems or whatever, or, you know. And there are things that I want to do with the game that I have a feeling are the exact opposite of some of the reasons why players would sign up to be in one of my games instead of some other game in the first place. And we're going to have to settle all of that with a session zero. It's the only way to work. The other thing is I did have one player who kind of had his heart set on reprising the character he created for the original game because he really wanted to do that. And I initially said that would probably be possible, but really I need to strip everything down and start fresh and from scratch. So while I'm excited to run the game, I am also really nervous about balancing the player's desires against my needs and finding a game that will fit within the constraints I have when I already struggle to run online games. Jorkon the D3 asks, what makes Final Fantasy IV better than Final Fantasy VI? And I blathered on about this and launched into a rant about the failings of Final Fantasy VI last time. And the thing is, I am a little bitter about Final Fantasy VI because I am replaying it right now. I have replayed Final Fantasy IV several times in my life. I have replayed Final Fantasy VI maybe once since it first came out. And I have decided to do that again. I'm using the Game Boy Advance ports because they strike, I think, the best balance between the original things that I am nostalgic for because I played them on the Super Nintendo, and you know, updated translations and bug fixes and things. And in general, I am liking the translation of Final Fantasy VI. I also really enjoyed Final Fantasy IV on Game Boy Advance when I replayed that not too long ago. But there are, and I don't want to go into a rant on everything Final Fantasy VI did wrong. It is a, it's a perfectly fine game. I don't hate it. But that said, I find the characters to be much more shallow in Final Fantasy VI than Final Fantasy IV. They are fairly cookie cutter, and the large number of characters means the amount of character development and plot arcs and interesting developments are actually fairly small and shallow. On top of that, one of the things I'm struggling with is the whole thing with... I just dropped something heavy. Ignore that clatter. Okay. The whole thing with Final Fantasy VI is I feel like the characters, mechanically, their identities are all screwed up. Like, every character has a special ability that makes sure that they don't have to do just a basic fight attack, right? Which is neat and all, but it means that equipment is almost entirely useless for most of the characters. Because you're always using these special attacks, like Sabin's Street Fighter moves, or like Edward's tools, or Edgar's tools, not Edward, Edgar. Edward's the Spoony Bard. But anyway, and the connection between the game's stats and how those affect those abilities is kind of difficult to disentangle. Like, I only discovered just now that, like, half of Sabin's blitzes are tied to his magic stat. I'm going in the weeds now. Okay, here is my point. Many of the characters have one special ability that you just kind of spam over and over again. Or, that's except for the characters whose special abilities are giant useless pains in the asses. And anybody who's played Final Fantasy VI knows what I mean. On top of that, every character can equip and learn any magic spell in the game using the Esper system. Which you can also use for stat building if you know what you're doing. But as I said, that's a little bit cryptic. So instead, what you have is this pile of characters, and about half of them have special abilities, that's all they do. And the other half are mechanically just generic, you know, teach them all the spells and just let them go to town, especially because magic is much more powerful than anything. I'm not going to say that. Okay. Except for a certain number of characters, except for two characters' special abilities, really, magic is way more powerful than anything else, and you can basically customize every character to everything, which means mechanically the characters don't resonate with me. They don't have strong identities. You know, it's not like Cecil is the paladin and Rydia is the caller and Rosa is the white mage. You know, it's just like, okay, and then this is the guy who, you know, what spells does Locke even know right now? You know, so... It's just kind of... Also the pacing. Once you get past the World of Balance into the second half of the game, it's pulling the air brake on the pacing. Because it is basically now just an open world. Now go find all your characters and build your levels up to beat the final boss a la Breath of the Wild. You know, the beginning of the game is rather unevenly paced. The second half of the game... it's basically just a pacing blob. It's just a big old pacing soup. Like, just, you know, there's the world, go do whatever. So I will take Final Fantasy IV for its stronger characters, its much tighter narrative, its better pacing, and its stronger mechanical character identities. Doug, any game systems that are coming up that you are looking at for inspiration for Smafarge? I got to be really careful talking about Smafarge now, especially considering the big changes that are coming up very, very near future. So I'm not going to answer that question. And really, as I indicated yesterday when I tried to answer this question the first time, I don't have as much time as I would like to play with other systems. I have dozens and dozens of systems that I still have to read just to take a look at. I still haven't checked out Pathfinder 2, and I really do need to. Okay, like, I need to figure out a way to at least learn Pathfinder 2 a little bit. for reasons. I really need to check out the Without Number games by Kevin Crawford. I still haven't played any of the Modiphius games, and I would really like to try Star Wars Adventure or the Conan game. And I've been looking more at some of the OSR stuff these days. I bought Adventure Conqueror King and never got to try it. I'm looking at Castles and Crusades now. Years ago, I used to be really good at trying out all sorts of different game systems. And then around 2014 or so, I became very tunnel visioned and was focused very mainly on D&D, except for going to conventions and trying out other games here and there. And I really don't think you can get a good read on a system from a one shot. I think if you want a good read on a system, there's two things you need to do. Number one, you need to run it as it is written, with a published adventure or a pre-written adventure or a starter adventure. And number two, you need to run it for roughly 10 to 12 sessions. And then you can confidently say you know something about the system. Procillus, I've always wanted to run a character like Cecil, learning what it means to be a paladin. I really liked him in 4. I loved Cecil. He is one of my favorite characters in video games. Doug asked, this is again a carryover from yesterday. Doug asked yesterday, what modern systems do you feel provide a good subset of tools for a GM? And I made this flippant remark about what do GMing tools even look like, and then I pointed out that I really haven't, my experience with other systems lately is kind of limited, though I do look for systems with really interesting tools, which is why I'm interested about the Without Number games, because there's a tagging system that I really, really, really want to look at. I'm still sad because I haven't really had a chance to dig into Shadow of the Demon Lord too much. And there's the advancement system is something in there that I really, really, really want to take a look at. But I'm also enamored of the advancement system in Conan. I'm not saying any of these are things that I'm looking at for Smafarge per se. They are just things I am interested in. One thing I did that someone tweeted very recently that I got super interested in, and it's just this short little pamphlet on dungeon building, is this thing called cyclic dungeon generation. And I offered this as an example of what a GMing tool would look like, mainly because Doug did follow up by saying, well, here's the tools I'm looking for: narrative advice, pacing advice, building systems for the yada, yada, yada. And I kind of dug into that a little, which was unfair. Because I said, those aren't tools, that's advice. Advice and tools are different. And then I pointed out that, a good example of a GMing tool is like the take 10 and take 20 mechanic from D&D 3.5, which I have not stopped talking about, because that is basically a mechanical device that stops a GM from misusing the dice system. And then I offered cyclic dungeon generation as another example of a tool, because this is a really good example of how to build what I call macro challenges. A macro challenge, like in D&D, you face a lot of micro challenges. There's an encounter, you overcome it. There's an encounter, you overcome it. And then that's it. Those are micro challenges, a one and done kind of a challenge. A macro challenge is you have to coordinate things to overcome a larger challenge. So if you had to infiltrate a lair to get some information or to assassinate a boss or assassinate a leader, and there were guard patrols and all of those things. Individual patrols might represent the micro challenges, but plotting a route through the dungeon, avoiding raising the alarm, or, dealing with the raised alarm and building up, and gathering intelligence so you can find the person you want to kill and then assassinating them, that's a macro challenge. That's where you have to coordinate a bunch of different things outside of just succeeding in the encounters to make victory possible. This cyclic dungeon generation document, and I'll post a link to it, by Sursa Victory, is a great example of what I mean by macro challenges. And it's a really brilliantly written thing that I wish I had written, because I feel like he cracked a code that I wished I had cracked. All right. Procillus, this might be a silly question. What's the difference between a hack and a homebrew? And I said yesterday, this was not Yeah, and I realize I'm going back to the yesterday pool a lot, but once I get through these questions, I'll have some new ones. I mean, these are just terms, right? And gamers are very careless about their terms. To me, the difference between a homebrew and a hack is in it with a, when you are homebrewing, you are basically using the tools and elements from the game system and maybe designing some custom stuff within the constraints of the system. So maybe using the custom monster tools or using advancement rules or giving monsters classes and things like that. But you're mostly just putting together the pieces that the system already provides you. Whereas hacking is actually about rewriting the rules or building new rules and building new systems. Okay. Wes Belmont thanked me for another year of articles and said, this year I've started running more homebrew and making a concerted effort to improve my games. Each article helps me get better and have more fun with my friends each week. And I am really glad for that. I'm glad your games are going well, and I'm glad that I was able to help. And also, I have to acknowledge that the only thing harder to deal with online than being disagreed with is being complimented. Nobody ever knows how to handle a compliment. So I always end up getting flustered whenever anyone says thanks or good work. So Wes, thanks for your compliment. I am glad your games are running better, and good job taking my advice and turning it into a better game, because I'm only giving you the tools. You actually have to act on it. So never forget that. Wiley asked, what do D&D and OSR do differently in regards to the fantasy genre? Feel free to skip. Oh, man. I rambled for a long time about genre conventions and things. And I really don't... Okay. Short version here, just to rehash this because the old recording is dead. The issue with genres is always that genres are descriptive, right? They come after the fact. They come after a bunch of stories have been written, and people notice that stories have certain themes in common and certain ideas in common, and you can kind of put them together. So if you enjoy this story and this story, you're likely to enjoy this other story. You call them all a genre. Over time, as more and more things get added to a particular genre, and people begin to experiment with the genre and push out the bounds of the genre, genres expand. So once upon a time when I was a kid, we had one genre, it was called science fiction and fantasy. You went to a bookstore, there was a science fiction and fantasy section. In libraries, there was a science fiction and fantasy section, right? Gradually, science fiction and fantasy split, and science fiction then started to split into science fiction, science fantasy, space, you know, yada, yada, yada. And there's all sorts of subgenres and stuff, right? And meanwhile, fantasy has started to split. So you have your high fantasy and your low fantasy and your epic fantasy and your urban fantasy, which I don't even think should be called fantasy, but what do I know? Yada, yada, yada. So the problem with answering these questions about how do these things approach the fantasy genre differently is that modern D&D and OSR are operating on different definitions of the fantasy genre at this point. The OSR is steeped in the older definition of fantasy, one that is a little bit more limited, a little bit lower in scope and scale and things like that, whereas modern fantasy is much more over the top and kind of starts to fall into what I would almost call like this, like what D&D calls the fantasy genre, I wouldn't call fantasy these days. I would call it superheroes in a medieval setting, you know, in a magical medieval setting. So it's really hard to say what these two things are doing differently with regards to the fantasy genre, because I think they are so, like D&D, modern D&D, D&D post year 2000, and OSR games and old versions of D&D, they are, I would say, completely different genres of game at this point. Okay, Gondave asks, how and when, or when and how early during the world building did you decide your world has a second moon and that it has an erratic cycle? My world has had two moons for a very, very long time. Years. It's enough so that I can't remember exactly when the second moon happened. the second moon became erratic and random just about 2 years ago at the start of a campaign which was featured around, which started at a celestial event, a festival welcoming a comet that would appear in the sky, and it only appeared on the dark of the moon every 10 years when both moons were new. And that's when I sort of blurted out the whole idea that the crimson moon is random and crazy. And so that's how it happened. As a general rule, nothing is decided about my world until it's decided because of a plot. Okay, I don't do world building. I write adventures. I don't even write stories, okay? I write adventures. I write scenarios to run at the table. And those things define the world. And until I have written an adventure, a thing is not true of the world. Does that mean that, you know, I don't build ancillary things into those adventures? No, of course not. Like, certain details will just pop up that aren't really related to the adventure or necessary for the adventure, but they just come into the world. Likewise, if somebody asks a question at the table and I answer it, then world details are discovered. Okay. Wiley is asking, and these are now new questions, and I think I have only like 15 minutes left, but I'm still building up more questions. Okay. Can you describe the difference between the bones of a game and the whole gameplay experience? I'm personally missing out on the performance piece. Okay, so I think, and Wiley is not present today to clarify this, so I'm going to have to go with my best guess. I think this is in reference to what I mentioned in the article about how I would write the bones of a game, you know, drawing a dungeon on graph paper, and then take it to the table to actually see what happens. And then, you know, what is actually the difference? And a lot of the difference just comes down to the fact that I don't try to put too much detail into anything. Like, I will, if I'm designing a dungeon, I will decide there's goblins here because there's goblins here. And I won't necessarily know the reason why there's goblins here. Okay, I might have an idea, I might not, but goblins might just seem like a good idea in that room. I might name the goblins, I might write personalities if I feel like I'm going to need that, but I don't necessarily do that, and even then my notes are fairly limited. When I get to the table, I will actually run that as an interesting... Okay, I'll give you an example. Okay, there was a stealth challenge in my game 2 weeks ago where the players had to get into an archaeological site that they wanted to explore, but the guild that had claimed the site had hired some locals to just stand watch over the site and, you know, raise the alarm if anybody tried to get in. I drew a map of the site, you know, or the, you know, the outside of the site where the guards would be. And I wrote three guards. I gave them names and I gave them very, very short backstories and descriptions. This guard, you know, took the job because they are a mercenary and they just want money. And this guard took the job because he's young and his parents are sick and he's trying to help his family by, you know, getting money. And then the third one was, this guy took the job because his son works for the guild and he's, you know, so he's super loyal, right? And so I just wrote those little details and that was it. And then at the game table, I rolled randomly to see which guards were present. And as the players were scouting the site, I moved the guards around where I thought the guards should be. And then I had them come and go a little bit. You know, I had a little bit of a shift change just because it seemed like the right moment right thing to do, right? Okay, let's have a shift change so that the players can see the guards coming and going, get a sense that there's more than one. I can't say why I did that other than while I was running the game, it seemed like the right thing to do. At some point, another guard came to the site to have a conversation with the dude on duty. And honestly, the way that that actually happened because of a slip up. Okay, I was covering my tracks because I narrated something and then a player sort of retconned their action And I was playing with cutscenes. So it's a long story, but basically I suddenly had to have two people talking to make up for a piece of careless narration I had done because I zealously narrated an action that the player turned out they didn't want to take, or I misunderstood the action. So anyway, so now I had to have a conversation between these two guards because, you know, I needed people talking. And knowing the two guards' personalities, the one was trying to get the other one to cover to work a double shift, basically, so that she could go take on some other job because she's a mercenary. And she used the fact that the kid was desperate for money to help his sick family or whatever the hell it was to kind of like bully him into taking the job. And she was really mean about it. And one of the players, they snuck up to try and overhear the conversation. If they hadn't snuck up to overhear the conversation, I would have been home free. But since they snuck up to try and hear the conversation, I had to figure out what the conversation was. And that's when I decided, okay, well, it's a double shift. And, you know, the one guard's an asshole about it, which actually garnered some sympathy. My players had interesting reactions to seeing that. But it also created a unique opportunity, because if they infiltrated the site right then and there and skipped going to bed for the night, even though they might be a little bit tired, they knew that there would only be one guard on duty and he was already pulling a double shift and he'd be exhausted. And they took advantage of that. So that's what I mean by the difference between the bones of a game and the actual gameplay experience. The actual gameplay experience is where you take the elements that are there and then make decisions on the fly in reaction to what's happening in the game world to build something that provides both a satisfying gameplay experience and creates a satisfying narrative. Because it's got to be both. And, you know, people say, oh, yeah, just, you know, write villains and then tell an interesting story. And you can't just do that. It can't just be an interesting story. You have to have the game design part of it too. Like there, that whole situation presented my players a trade-off. If you stay up all night and infiltrate the site in the middle of the night, you will have an easier time getting in, but you may be exhausted. Okay. So anyway, Ice Bear asks, is the mostly monthly live chat now the monthly live chat? No, I missed one. I missed one in October, September or October. Due to illness, so it's still only mostly monthly. Gandave, to expand on my previous question regarding the second moon, how did you manage to introduce the erratic cycle of the moon without getting a wait? Was it like this the whole time? Why didn't we notice from the players? Because it was the start of a new campaign. As a general rule, I will not introduce anything that should not have been noticed. As a general rule, I've gotten really lax about running things in different campaigns, and this goes back to the first question I answered. I keep running games in the same setting, and somebody made some sarcastic remarks in response to sarcastic remarks I was making that made me reflect on whether or not I was, you know, hurting my abilities as a GM by just using the same setting over and over again. So already when I was having trouble trying to decide what to do with my upcoming new campaign, now on top of that, I don't even want to set it in the same world anymore because I feel like I'm a failed GM because someone called me on my own bullshit and hypocrisy. And thanks for that. I can't even remember who it was, but thanks for that. I want to say it was Merman Roy. It was Richard Merman Roy, Roy Merman. Just sort of called me out and said, well, isn't that what you're doing? Like, I pointed out, like, you know, running in the same setting, running the same system over and over again, there's a degree of comfort that comes from that, that kind of, you know, it prevents you from stretching your skills. There was a long conversation about it. And I was basically being a contrarian there and trying to get people to think about the other side of an issue. And then he called me out and was like, well, you know, like what you do with the Angryverse. I'm like, shit. Well, now I can never run another campaign in the Angryverse. So that's it. Merman Roy ruined my campaigns. Anyway, so it's like, in general, though, I do not retcon things. If I retcon things, I will say, hey, I'm retconning this. Like, I know the moon never behaved like this before, but the moon behaves like this now, and you need to pretend it always did. You know. But in general, there's a lot of details that go unstated, and anything that has not been explicitly stated is open to change. And if the players do ask something like that, well, wait, if it was like this the whole time, why didn't we notice? I'll just be honest. I'll say, because I didn't decide it until now. You know, but it was. Can we, you know, I'll just be honest. You know, I'm not going to lie and say I have created the, you know, my world is this rich, detailed thing with 1,000 pages of description or what have you. What am I at for time, by the by? Because I still have a bunch of questions, and I don't want to cut this off 45 minutes and stop the questions. But let's see. Dan Floor. I have been using that cyclic dungeon generator tool to prep my next dungeon, and I've fallen in love with it. Yeah, I really want to play with it. I actually, I'm looking at two things from it. Number one is using it for non-dungeons. And number two is, and oh my God, I shouldn't even say this because I know the Pantera's box that I'm going to open here. But I think there's a neat way to get mega dungeons out of this. And anyway, next question. Minstrel, the beholder, the many-eyed beholder. What do you actually, he's not a many-eyed beholder. He has the perfectly normal number of eyes for a beholder. What do you consider your greatest GM or Angry Incorporated accomplishment of 2022? That one's an easy one. I ran the non-con for like, for 30 people. So, you know, that was awesome. That was it. Pulled off that convention on what I can only call extreme last minuteness. Extreme last minute. In the last minute. Yeah. Because, like, apparently you really should take more than a year out to set that stuff up instead of the 6 months that we actually set it up in. And I'm really, really grateful to everyone that helped make that a success. The Tiny GM, Debit Victory, and then, of course, everybody who came and ran games there who are far too many to list. But and of course, everybody who showed up and played. You know, everybody was awesome. So that was it. That was the greatest Angry Incorporated accomplishment of 2022. And my best memory of the year was gathering 35 or so people all in one hotel ballroom and playing games for 36 hours. Noided. Do you have solutions, methods, or rules for mitigating your big grievances with 3.5, or do you just sigh and deal with them? I don't even sigh. They're fine. I mean, look, every game is going to have its warts. And you just kind of ignore them or work around them or whatever. Okay. Like, you cannot fall into the perfect solution fallacy, or else you will never, ever run a game. No game system is perfect. So the key to picking a good game system is to find the game system that does all the things you want a game system to do and doesn't do anything that you can't just cope with. Okay? Because, I mean, everybody's like, oh, you can fix the system and you can rewrite the rules and you can hack the system. It's like, I don't want to do any of that. I just want to run friggin' games. Yeah, I could fix every issue I have with 3.5. I could probably fix every issue I had with 5e. It would take me 9 months, but I could write 5.5. I could write, you know, Angry Finder, the Pathfinder of 5e. I thought about it, too. Like, I know the things that would need to be fixed. I could probably do it, but I don't want to do it. D&D 3.5 works better for me than 5e, and all of its warts are things that I can just sort of live with and get over. Wes Belmont, how do you gather player feedback? How do you gather feedback about your sessions? What sort of questions are useful to ask? I don't ask questions. Asking questions is useless. I just listen to the players. If the players are I don't know. Feedback's really overrated. Okay, there's a lot of things that are overrated in the GMing community, and I'm now going to go on a mini rant, and I'm also going to tell Procellus to just stay off the mute button, because I'm going to extend this and just handle the questions, and if he needs to bow out as producer, that's fine. I'll go until my clock says 2 o'clock, which will be an hour instead of 45 minutes, and this becomes a long live chat, but whatever. Okay, so here's the mini rant. Okay. Becoming a good GM is experiential, holistic, intuitive, and not conscious. I constantly get questions of what sort of drills can I run on myself between games to get better at running games? Or what feedback questions can I use to determine how well I am doing? And all of that. All that shit is overrated, and it is not how human beings learn complex skills. There are going to be people who disagree with me. There always are. Every time I say that, they are wrong. Okay? The research is clear on this. And I, you know what? And I, at this point, you can either trust me to have done the homework or you can go do the homework yourself. Okay? But here's the thing. This is how you get better at running games. You keep running games until you're good at it. That's it. That's the only thing. Hell, even reading my advice is half useless. It gives you some shit to try. But, you know, like, most of the people who are reading my advice and taking my advice are people who are already inclined to agree with me anyway. That's just the fact of the matter. I can give you some tricks to use. I can give you some tools. I can give you some things to think about. But end of the day, none of it is useful. It's just running games and not trying to evaluate things. Because here is the thing. On an intuitive, non-conscious level, your brain knows whether you are successful or not at the things you have done. Okay, it is aware of far more information than you take in consciously. Okay, that is why you can look at people and get a sense of their mood. Okay, you can't point at any one thing and just say, okay, that's how I know this person is this. And there's no magic thing like if a person moves their eyes to the left and they say this. Okay, all that shit has been debunked. But what is left with the fact that on a non-conscious level, you are very aware of pretty much everything. Okay, so your brain is taking in a huge amount of information and it knows how to evaluate when things are going well and when things are going poorly. So the absolute best thing you can do to learn any complex skill, and I'm talking complex here, because GMing is a complex skill, is a mishmash of 10,000 different little skills. Everything from storytelling and performance to game design to things like conflict resolution and social interaction and just reading a room and public speaking, you know, and, you know, just writing well, all of these things and logistics and just, you know, organization skills, it's all in there. It's a giant mess of skills. And the only way to get good at it is to just keep doing it. And what happens is every time you attempt to do something, okay, your brain builds connections between all the different little parts of it that handle all the little different things. This is called neuroplasticity. Okay. After you do a thing, if your brain thinks that was successful, then it secretes chemicals that lock in the new connections it has formed, the new things that associate this particular intuitive awareness of this facial expression with you did good narration. Okay, your word choice. Okay, it's you're a giant neural network, right? If you do badly, your brain secretes different chemicals, or it doesn't secrete the chemicals, and then those associations don't get locked in as strongly. Over time, gradually, with every hit, the associations your brain keeps building get stronger and stronger, and the associations that your brain built that were the wrong paths get weaker and weaker and weaker, and this is how experiential learning works. For any practical complex skill, this is how you learn, okay? This is not how you're going to learn math. You do not learn math intuitively or physics. But complex practical skills, you know, of actually doing things and actually creating things are learned experientially. You're looking for ways to let your conscious brain get involved in that. But more often than not, your conscious brain is actually getting in the way. Your conscious brain is the part of you that's going to second guess yourself. The conscious brain is the part of you that's going to tear you down. The conscious brain is the part that is going to misinterpret anything any player says based on the mood you have toward the game you think you ran. So if you think you ran a crappy game and then you ask the players what they think and they're anything less than effusive, you're going to interpret that as they hated the game because they saw what a bad job you did because you know you did a bad job. Your conscious brain is a mess. It gets in the way. So forget feedback, forget drilling. Just run games and run games and run games. And if you want to know how you're doing, I'm going to tell you something that my golf pro, my golf instructor, whatever, told me that stuck with me for a long time. Okay. Because it is very, very hard to see progress building complex iterative skills. Okay. And you tend to focus on your best moments, your best shots, or the best games you've ever run. And that's the wrong way to evaluate yourself. If you want to know how you're doing, take a good long look at the worst things you do, your worst golf shots, or your worst games. Over time, you will notice the worst games and the worst golf shots or the worst anythings get less worse. Okay, that's where you see the improvement. You see much more improvement, especially, you know, in the early stages of building a skill, in getting rid of the mistakes and doing it and not doing as many things wrong, than you do see your best games getting better. But everybody fixates on their best games as the way to evaluate things. Other than that, just listen to your players. If your players are talking about your game, and when you leave the game, if they're talking about the things that happened during the game, then, or if they're talking about their plans for next game, or if they're talking about the characters as if they're people, they're like, oh, I can't believe, you know, I was really pissed off when she made the kid dance for that coin, because he was desperate for money to take care of his sick family. What a jerk. When your players say something like that, you did it right. Okay. And if you run a game online, then here's a trick you can use to feel better about the games you run. And that is this. Hold the call open for a little while at the end and let the players chat, and you sit quietly and make it so, oh, I got to figure out experience points, you know, and then you just kind of let the players talk, or you just prompt them to talk. You just say things like, hey, I had a lot of fun tonight, you know, thanks for playing. And then, you know, the players will jump in and say, yeah, I had a lot of fun too. You know, the that scene was a lot of fun. And someone will say, yeah, I can't believe that person did that. And then you get them talking, you listen to them talk about the game, and you realize they're talking, and they're talking about a good time they just had. And that will make you feel better. Because really the only reason you need feedback is to shore up your confidence. Because as you're practicing and getting better at things, it hurts because you're not good at them. You know, and even when you get good at them, you're still not good at them. I have a bad habit of apologizing at the end of every game session. I end every game session that I run with, and if my players are listening right now, they're going to nod when I say this because they're going to know it. At the end of every game session, I say, hey, thanks for playing. I'm sorry I was so off tonight, or I'm sorry my narration sucked, or I'm sorry about the pacing, or I'm sorry about the... I always have something to apologize for because, you know, the first thing I fixate on is the thing I screwed up. And the sad thing is, my players probably don't even notice that crap, or maybe they do because I suck, but I don't know. But they probably don't even notice that crap until I apologize for it. And not only does that bring me down, because by apologizing for it, I'm making myself feel bad about it, it also means that instead of letting my players have the fun, relaxing conversation after the game, they instead say, end up having to reassure me that everything was fine. So anyway, I don't remember what the question was, but long story short, run games until you're good at it. Okay. Drago asks, if you are emulating Final Fantasy VI, there's a patch out there that fixes the soundtrack by patching the SNES version of the music. Yeah, I got the soundtrack on the Game Boy Advance version. Oh my God, that is shit. That game had a good soundtrack. It's, you know, it's not really, it's the sound font of the Game Boy Advance, right? It just doesn't have the sound power that the Super Nintendo did. The sound power had an excellent sound chip. But, and I know the Genesis had a better sound chip, but the sound font that the SNES used was just better overall, in my opinion. But anyway, yes, thank you for that information. I have never in my life figured out how to patch a ROM. Not that I would emulate, because emulating is terrible. Logic Dragon, how freely available is Magic to buy and sell in your 3.5 games? For example, do your players ever take downtime to sell their spells for big bucks? I don't think it ever occurred to my players that they could do that. I mean, I know there is a price list for spellcasting services. And yes, so they could, you know, in their downtime, conceivably, like, take time to try and sell their spellcasting services. In general, I'm not sure the demand is very high. Like, magic is not freely available in any Dungeons & Dragons game I run, because I want to run fantasy, and I want magic to feel magical. And if it's freely available, you're not running fantasy and it's not magical. Okay, now it's just industry that runs on a different rule law of physics. Okay, and I'm not running that Eberron bullshit. So it's not freely available. If my players did decide to try and make money professionally in their downtime, selling their spells for big bucks, number one, the demand would not be tremendously high. They could probably make money at it, but they would still be more profitable going on adventures. So, you know, spending less downtime in town and more time adventuring. So, you know, because I never want not playing the game to be more profitable than playing the game. The other thing is that very few of my players play characters that are motivated by profit. You know, there's a lot of other motivations to play for, and you know, just making money is not one of them. So, Noided is asking, I guess this is the last question, so unless another question comes in while I'm answering this one, this would be a good place to stop, which I now realize I'm just asking people to ask a question, but here we go. For downtime mode, is it smart to give players a list of different tasks they can do in town and how they are resolved, or does it become limiting push button? I don't know yet. To be totally honest, this is something that needs more experimentation. Okay? There is a balance to be struck. Okay? And players should know how things are resolved and how actions in town work. But by the same token, you don't want it to become like Persona, where it's, well, even Persona, it isn't like this. Okay? Even Persona manages to keep it steeped in the world. But you don't want it like, okay, just assign your cat. Like, you don't want a worker placement game, right? Where you just have a map of town and you say, okay, now everybody assign your character to a task for the day. And then everybody puts their little token down and then you resolve all the actions and they take their tokens back and do it again. You don't want that to become how downtime town mode works. I am trying to find the magic formula that is repeatable enough for me to tell everyone else about it. So, yeah, I don't know yet. Talk to me in 6 months, I guess. This is why I have to keep this one campaign going, because it is basically set up around a single home-based town. So it lets me play with different kinds. I did find one that failed. I found a downtime model that totally bombed last time. But that's a story for another time. No one wants to hear how I screwed up my game. Besides, I've already shared two stories about how I'm a fuck-up, so that's enough for today. Logic Dragon. I meant, how easy is it for players to buy, sell magic in general? Like, did you have to seek out the world's one magic shop, or will any big city have someone? Oh, okay, that's easy. I run D&D 3.5 by the book. So, you know, the book tells you how the book covers it. Okay, like, for example, if you're seeking spellcast services, I know in my town right now, there is a second level divine spellcaster and the players have found him. The players have met him. If they need spells up to, well, first level divine spells cast on their behalf, there's someone they can go to. Okay, I know how many spellcasters there are in a town that has spells available. As far as magic item availability, I haven't looked into it yet because my players aren't at the point where they can make the money. They have the money. But again, like, I know the highest level artisans and experts in the town, and I know what level things like crafting magic items are and crafting masterwork weapons are. So again, I can tell you whether this stuff is available in a town, and I find that the level of rarity... Okay. Ooh, this is going to be like, what am I looking at? 4 minutes now until my other self-imposed deadline. I don't know if I can deal with this right now. Yeah, I just proselytized. Thanks for the 4 minute warning right there. Okay. Okay. There is a fundamental flaw in the question. It is a fundamental flaw. And many GMs ask this question. Like, how rare should there be one magic item shop or no magic item shops? Or should magic items be freely available? Or, you know, how to do all blah, 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 blah. There is a fundamental flaw in the question. Because the answer does not matter one bit. So. This is really what it comes down to. Okay. The players decide they want to acquire a magic item. Well, okay. No, there's... This is really... Yeah, I'm trying to think. This is something that needs some thought. I know what I'm trying to say. I'm on the verge of a revelation here. Okay. This is the difference between magic item systems. Okay. Is there a list of magic items the players can buy? Or not. If you put a list in front of the players, and it's like, here are the magic items that are available for sale. Like, you know, in going into the Final Fantasy games, you walk into a shop and you click buy, and then there's a list of, oh, you can buy the fire sword and the giant sword and all of that stuff, right? Okay. Is there a list that you are willing to put in front of your players that says, okay, here's the magic items that are available for sale or commission. You can acquire those. Or is every magic item the players want to acquire or sell a thing you have to resolve at the table? That is the only choice. Everything else is set dressing. Okay. Because no matter what, if the players have to jump through hoops, even if the hoop is just something as simple as there's only one magic shop in the world and the players have to find it, and then they can go there and it only has a certain stock every time, and every time they go there it's different, then you have rare magic. If the players know what's available for sale and can freely buy potions and scrolls and things like that, or make them themselves, then you have common magic. Everything else is set dressing. Okay, because for practical purposes, it's all going to play out at the game table the same way. Penguin. This is the last comment, and then I'm going to say goodbye. Penguin. Failed experiments are usually useful experiments. Yeah, that's kind of, you learn more from failures than successes, except not necessarily. Okay. A failed experiment eliminates one path. And when you have an infinite number of paths to take, yes, sometimes eliminating one path can be useful, but there are other better ways to figure out which paths are more likely to get you where you want to go first. Anywho, people, this is another thing GMs overvalue. They overvalue mistakes. You learn more from mistakes than successes. No, you don't. No, you actually don't. Anyway, with that said, I am going to wish everyone a happy new year, and I'm going to thank everybody for coming back for this encore, re-record, impromptu replacement Q&A that I'm going to try and get out as soon as possible, depending on when Ratter Crash can remix it. But I really appreciate everyone hanging out and letting me do this, because I really did feel bad by the time I ended the last one. And I still feel like I gave some things sort of short shrift and had to rush through some things today. But at least we got to take plenty of time. And I hope there was some interesting information in there for you. Thanks again, everybody, for, you know, all of your support through the year and putting up with me through my lows and highs. Thanks again to everybody who made NonCon such a success. That was a really big thing for me. As I said, that was probably the greatest moment of my gaming year, and it was mainly everybody else who made it that way. Thanks to my players, if they're listening, for putting up with me and agreeing to restart the campaign even after I blew that first one completely apart. Or those players in my other game who are just thinking everything is going along fine and don't think I'm having a major existential GMing crisis and everything's fine. No, but seriously, thanks to all my players for showing up every time and having a great time and making it such a pleasure to run games. Thank you to everyone. Thank you for every member of this community for making the community such a wonderful place. Thank you to those of you I've had altercations with who have generously forgiven me as I struggle with some mental health issues again toward the end of the year. And I think that's it. Thank you to absolutely everyone for absolutely everything ever. And happy new year to you all, and to all a good night.